Hello and welcome to episode 70 of the Mad Axeman Wargaming Podcast. And this week we've got an absolute near 2 hour doozy of an episode for you. Of course, the regular gang are here and we cover all of the usual topics. There's a long discussion about painting, we talk about transatlantic shopping, what we're going to be doing going forwards. There's some interesting games that have been played this week. But more importantly, we've got one of our best ever episodes of I'm Sorry, I Think You're an Arse, a very firmly tongue-in-cheek, and please remember that, series in which we talk about big wargaming issues of the day. Andy's quiz returns, Andy's quiz music returns, and there's some great little outtakes at the end for those of you who can bear to listen to the end of the podcast. So sit back, pin back your ears, and listen to the podcast. This means war. Well, welcome. Here I sit almost as the Oprah Winfrey of War Games, surrounded by a Zoom screen of six other people with all our regular guests dialing in from around the southeast of England and places of that ilk. So we're here for another week of the Mad Axeman podcast. I believe, depending on if I manage to sneak out a Army List podcast between now and when this one actually gets published, this will be either number 70 or 71. So we've got a kind of duality of numbering for this one. But whilst we don't know what the numbers are, and we don't quite know what that is, what we do know is that we're going to go straight into our regular routine. And that routine is to look at who's been painting, what have they been painting, and what's been happening on the purchasing front this week. So if I start with my top left, which would be Simon, coming to you in your kitchen, first of all. That looked like a very tidy kitchen you've got back there with empty shelves behind you. Is that going to be a new War Games cabinet for all your stuff? What's been going on this week in the Simon painting and shopping world?
Yeah, we're not talking about the using the cupboards here for additional miniature storage. That's on the governance committee for next week.
Okay. All right. Be put to the vote.
Yeah, I have to develop the business case better, do some Venn diagrams, a couple of magic quadrants.
And I'm guessing if there's a 50-50 split, you don't hold the casting vote on that one?
No.
Fine.
Excellent. All right. Casting vote, you're assuming he has a vote in the first place.
Yes, that could be true.
Simon is disenfranchised.
Yes. No, he's allowed to vote, it just doesn't count for anything.
Yeah, I could say whatever I want, and no.
It's special stock holdings where you have preferred voting rights.
Yeah, they're B shares or something like that, right?
No, I think the idea is that Rachel's got the two-handed weapon, so she wins ties. Mm.
Yes, that would be it, definitely. Yes, approaches you with a two-handed bladed instrument. So what has managed to sneak into Simon's post bag this week, or onto Simon's paint table?
So nothing's been purchased. It's still trying to be good. They are starting to weaken. So I've seen a few shiny miniatures. Mm. But the biggest thing I've achieved this week really has been to finish. So I've done all the matte varnishing, the basing, flocking of all the last of the Turkish army, the Lanchnik light artillery, or in most armies it would be called heavy artillery, and a few levy units. So, and also the... for my Rampant Dragon Army, I've got the big Skaven Wheel of Doom thing of silliness. It's a big wheel with sides and lots of spears and that, powered by rats. So they're all...
Great colours on that.
You shared that on our WhatsApp group. Yeah, that was really neat, isn't it?
You mentioned it last week that you had that.
Yeah. You know, it's like being run over by a carnival ride.
It's good. It's one of the main things you can do with rats here, because you don't take it too seriously. So it's just quite bonkers.
Yeah.
So,
as a question, are you still posting up pictures on your blog, or is that slightly fallen by the wayside in recent months?
It has fallen by the wayside, but I do have to get off my backside and
post. Remember the password.
So, because I've now got the light box, and I... did a big capital investment. I bought a 7-pound tripod for my phone so I can take better photographs. So I might actually sit down and try to do some better photographs and put them on the blog.
Okay. All right. So that's going along. So how many bases then do you admit to there being in your ADLGR or ADLG Ottoman army?
35 or something.
35, right, okay. So, and it's probably, what, a 22, 23 unit army, if that, or?
Yeah, so it's about 22, 23 logical, because the battle elements count for two bases. But I've got enough to do six B battle groups of Janissaries, plus then the, because they were on special, it'd be really good to support suppliers. Then you have a few different colours. You can have ones that are elite, not elite, and all that. You've got the rabble, because just having city rabble just sounds cool. And then for the cavalry, I've tried to have all the options. So you can do the couple crawlies and the nice, real, pretty impact ones. Lots of the heavy cavalry, lots of the medium cavalry, so they're very different. Buckle loads of light horse, a few different generals, stuff like that. So it's nice to have all the options just in case you want to go, let's try something stupid.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably one of the things that when we start gaming again, I think there's definitely going to be some sort of temptation just to, in fact, I was even thinking the other day to pull together a list of the armies that I want to try and put on table, mm-hmm. because there's probably a lot of slightly unusual compositions or different subsets that you're thinking, I just want to use that. Just to put it on table for even a game, just to try mm-hmm. it. And I suspect that's quite a long list now. Maybe that should be an exercise we could do for one of the podcasts. So yeah, so I think we got up on screen now one of, yes, your crazy rats in a wheel with electrical things zipping off
it. I do like the wires on it. I think that's a really neat touch.
Yeah, it just, why would you not want to paint up a model that looks that bonkers? You know?
You need a couple of necessary things. So what you need to do is utilize those wires and have a battery hidden somewhere. So if someone tries to pick it up, they get a quick zap.
It's my flocking machine.
Yes, get the flocking machine into action. How many volts? Yeah. 240 or go home? That one that we did before. No, that's superb. That's
something. I did do that when I used to play Warhammer back in the 1800s. You used to be able to get various upgrades to your tanks, like you'd get like spotlights and all that. So being a little bit bored, I actually made on the models spotlights that worked. And so you can take it to a competition, turn the lights on. It's like, did you put a spotlight in your tank? Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm a nerd. It's like, you know, little doof doof lights and all that. It's, you know, things to do, you know, wake at 3 a.m.
No, I think that's kind of a Malifaux thing as well. In fact, I'll come to you next, Adam, but I don't think either of us have done this, but Malifaux do some sets of kind of translucent versions of the models,
yeah.
mm-hmm. and that people, I've seen people build lights into them, which is kind of the obvious thing to do. But what about you? What other than not illuminating things that neither of us own, what have you been painting and finishing this week?
Well, a couple of things. It's those four cav, I've light horse for dashing stations. I've near enough done. They just need shield transfers, and I'm doing the wagon for the baggage as we speak. And I've got the chickens and the badger to do. So hopefully, I haven't been cracking on really loads. I've had to start working this week again. But hopefully that one's done. Yeah, it's hard work. Hopefully that'll be done by next week. And the other thing I did was I prepared a couple of those ship models that I was actually really, really pleased with, because I've been doing them now off and on for a lot more than a decade.
Wow.
And I've got quite a few. It might be close to 20 years. I've got quite a few. And it's taken me ages to figure out a way of... Because the hard bit is to put the masks on. Because they're quite soft metal, the models and the masks. But the masks have got to be absolute solid to be painted. Funnily enough, when you put the rigging on, that actually helps strengthen them. Hmm. But they've got to be pointing exactly the right direction, and they've got to be solid. So I've always used Araldite. The problem with Araldite is it takes about 10 minutes to dry. So I've done the Araldite, and then I've sort of like lent the masks against. I use a tray, so I can slip underneath the rim, and they're sort of, the mast supported by the tray, and then you do that thing where you hold your breath and walk out backwards cautiously, and then a lorry goes past on a road half a mile away and it shakes, and it's just a nightmare. But I figured out, a way to do it that's quite handy. Now, I used to, when I do the models, I did put Magna Base on the bottom of them because it just makes them easier to transport and more secure. But at first, same as doing War Games figures, I did the Magna Base last. But that makes no sense because you've got to pull it on and then you've got to cut round the hull and sort of like with a sharp knife and you might nick it and you might take off paint. So I've got into the habit of stewing it first, done. Mm. And now I've figured out what I do is when I do the arrow die, I do it around the bottom of the mast, but I don't do it on the bottom. And on the bottom, I put a little drop of super glue. So the mast goes through a hole in the ship and it rests on the magna base inside of the magna base underneath. And the super glue isn't strong enough to hold it with any strength, but it is strong enough to hold it in position for 10 minutes while the aldite dries. So it's sort of like I can walk out backwards and it doesn't move. And it's only got to hold it for 10 minutes before the aldite does its thing. So it's only taken me about 20 years to figure that out. So I've always claimed to be a fast burner.
And that would never have worked if you'd not started magna basing and cutting around the bottom of the ship. So you don't base them on scenic bases with water and stuff. You just
a lot of ship people that do ships and ship models do it on scenic bases with water. But and this is for Andy's game. Sort of the rules that
Alan has.
Alan. And his rules sort of you've got ramming, so bases kind of get in the way, and they also look, to be honest, a bit rubbish. So it's just ship model. If it's on a good terrained piece of sea, it just looks better.
Looks like a ship. Yeah.
Funnily enough,
have you seen the that new Warlord Games capital ships World War II game where they all come on kind of slightly, but almost it looks to me kind of over deep. Bases. It's kind of
they look like hovercrafts.
Yeah, they look like they're on hovercrafts. Yeah, it does seem a bit excessive.
It doesn't look good. And I see a lot of people that say clear plastic bases look good because then it's base and you can just see through it. But again, it's like I can see the clear plastic.
Yeah,
it's see through. It's see through, but it's not invisible. No. So it looks like a ship on a piece of plastic. No base, I think, looks best. Although for other ship models I've done, some have got a base because the 16,000, you need something to be able to pick the bloody things up, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. But these ones are 1250, so they're quite large and solid anyhow.
Okay, so a two-part glue scenario then.
Do you paint waves at the bottom of them, or do you just have it straight, flat?
Just straight, flat. So it's a ship model. So I don't get a modelled wake and I don't get the sort of like the wave sort of like going up a side. But to do that, you would need to put it on a base and then you would need to build it up. And the problem with that, and having the wake rushing past can look good, but the problem with that, if you do it as diorama, absolutely. But if you do it as a game, that base has then got to go on the table. And unless you've modelled the base to look the same as the table.
Your table.
It kind of looks out because water's different colour all over the place. So it's like different shades of blue or different shades of green. You know what I mean? So it's like you miss out on the wake.
You could just have multiple different bases with magnets at the bottom of the ship. You just click it onto different bases.
You could just shut up because if you give me an idea like that, I might actually start thinking about it.
You'd have to have ones that have got wake and ones that aren't for when the boat is stopping.
I refer the honourable gentleman to the answer I gave about 15 seconds ago.
Does it not also make a difference?
You know you're thinking about it. Whether it's a sunny day, you know you want to do it though.
And
you do.
Whether the sun's shining on the front or the back of the ship, or you know whether it's the beginning of the day or the end of the day, the angle of the sun.
Yeah, I think Andy.
Hey, don't forget different sea conditions as well.
He probably wants to put that suggestion where the sun doesn't shine. Never mind which way it's shining on the ship.
I quite agree. That's why my ship models have just got a wake and a bit of blue in them. You know, if anyone's got a problem with it, they don't have to play the game against me.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Okay, so
that's why for War Games figures, there's not a lot of point of highlighting them because which direction are you highlighting from?
Now that is taking us back to those Victrix 10mm tanks. I think in
that's my whole reason why I don't highlight.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm highlighting which way the light's coming from. This direction.
Yeah, yes, but the those Victrix 10mm tanks, the Shermans that I got. They're 27 page, 200 different paint, 0.03 mil aperture bedside airbrush technique. I think did have suggestions for highlighting them in a way that looked like a light was shining on them as well, which is so far beyond, I would imagine, anybody's normal painting technique for tanks, particularly if they're supposed to like drive around and turn their turrets around and blow stuff up. But yeah, no, it was a horrible flashback to the world's most.
Tim, you weren't paying attention. Last week, Adam said you should call them 144th, not 10 mil.
Yes, that's a very good point. Yeah, calm down, Adam. I'll put you on mute so you can't kick.
No, I said
away.
The manufacturer should make them and call them the scale. If you buy them, you can call them what you want.
Well, they've all got little names on the side, haven't they? So they come with a lot of stickers with the names. So
Fury kind of and the, things like that.
Yeah, Fury being the one that jumps out really is the obvious one. So you've just got some shield transfers and some baggage to do, then the Dacians are done. I can't imagine the ships are going to occupy weeks and weeks of your time. Or
no, it's like get them stuck together, sort of like, and then it's just a few sessions painting and then a couple of sessions doing the rigging, which involves quite a lot of swearing, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then they're done. And what I'm planning to do now, because it's like doing the big figures all the time, start to get a bit old. So I'm going to do one batch of French Ordnance 28 mil and then a batch of something else. So I might do those tanks that I got at the same time as you, then 28 mil. So I'll slowly get another ALG 28 mil army together while doing other things for interest as well.
It's funny when you were saying about swearing about the rigging, all I remembered, all I started thinking about was the Hornblower TV shows where they're swearing at the sailors to go up into the rigging and that, to get that all set up. So I've just got visions of Adam swearing at little sailors going up and fixing the rigging.
Yeah, you've not met his children and the way he's arranged the house, have you? No, it's remarkably familiar. But Peter, what about you and your luxurious hair? What increasingly luxurious hair? What have you been up to this week?
I've been swearing at winged hussars and their ability for the wings not to actually stay where I want them to. Certain Simons who manage to do theirs and post it and it all looks nicely bling, I just managed to stick my fingers together, which it was a little bit irritating to say the least. So I'm going to have another go possibly at the weekend and get some like Aradite and other things ordered. And Simon's taunting me with models that are actually made up with colours and things. See, Simon, you see, I'm looking at it from here and the highlighting's all wrong because it needs to be the other angle.
Yeah, the light's shining from the wrong place, I think. On
You need to turn your iPad around.
It's shining from midday. It should be shining from 3 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah. They fought, the Poles fought most of their battles in early afternoon, facing in a southwesterly direction, I think.
And where's the snow, you know? Well, so apart from that, I've been geeking out about the Khorasan miniatures for the Assyrians. So trying to work out a list on that. So that might be something, I went back to the podcast, but it might be something for another podcast later on where you guys can talk me into or out to how many chariots I really need and want. I know Adam was of the two chariot motif, but more is always
better. What I would say, if you're doing an order, don't just do a list for the Assyrians, do a list for later Babylonians and do a list for who are the chaps that live just to the north of Assyria? Can't remember. Not Hittite, it's
Connecticut.
Sorry?
Ugarit?
No, it's not Ugarit. Oh, I can't remember. They lived around Lake Van, got crushed by the...
Urartu,
that's Van, it. Because they all use the same figures. So forgetting...
I'm not sure they use the same figures. Is technically correct, Adam? I think they all dressed the same way.
They all dressed similarly. So, yes. Tim, buying too many more figures...
I like the idea of this a lot. Tim, I think we ought to do a podcast on the ultimate universal biblical age. I can stuff you up via many different armies. It's almost like the Condetti, but for the biblicals by the sound of it.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think it's odd because this week on Facebook, there's two separate people, one in the States and one in York. Steve Roper and Paul Johnston up in York come up and been using my wallpaper idea, and literally, so there's figures appearing on Facebook using the same wallpaper that appears.
Yeah,
on
but
my
the 1970s floral mock really isn't a good one. You know, it's just like, you know, the
honestly,
swirls
Peter, someone who's looking at me at the screen with that hairstyle isn't really in a strong position to critique the 1970s.
Well,
really,
you're just jealous. Well, I have hair for a style.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. But, yeah, and so is John Travolta. But
Yeah. Adam, I like the idea of the multi-tool army for like several different ones. So I definitely could do some advice on that, because the only thing I know about biblicals has gone from sort of like watching various Egyptian films, to be honest.
And I guess once that's there, there's a real strong reason to buy as big an order as possible from Khorasan.
Don't need to tell me twice. I'm quite happy to be talked into that. You know, I'm going to be aiming by the end of the month to order a sizable chunk. I've already dropped a couple of emails back and forth to him. So, yeah, looking forward to it. So I could do with some advice on that, guys. And if any of the listeners want to post in some ideas as well about how I can make that ultimate biblical universal Swiss Army tool.
So, Peter, with your chariots, the question is, how many of all of them do you buy? Is in Dubai all the heavy chariots, or just enough to do an up army?
So let's go back to my normal thing.
Isn't Dave the expert on buying too many chariots?
Knights. Do I like knights? Yes. Do I like charging in on things with knights? Yes.
Eight heavy chariots.
It's definitely worthwhile to, when you buy your army, to buy a few options. So I did a similar thing with my Egyptian army. I bought enough bits to make them into near Babylonians and other ones. So it's allowing you to morph your chariot army into quite a few different periods. Because, you know, yes, I know some troops are not the correct ones, other ones, but the guy with a bow in that period is a guy with a bow. So you have more fun with the chariot, and you can make more iconic.
The only chariot I don't like is the light chariots. I have sucked using light chariots. I've used light chariots in Indian armies. I've used light chariots in Celtic armies, and they always get stomped.
Yeah. No, there's, I think with light chariots, I think they're one of the troop types in, particularly in ADLG, who are probably on the list, or hopefully are on the list for a little bit of an improvement. Because they always just do sort of slightly underperform, don't they? I think it's, you know, having javelin to shoot for a lot of them means they get too close to the enemy and they've got a good chance of being caught. They just don't quite cut it. They probably need a little boost. But I think with the Assyrians, you're looking at getting four...
heavies.
Well, four of the heavies. And I think I've actually managed to persuade myself that I needed six, because then I've got two of them with generals, because you quite often have embedded generals and four of them without, because then that means you could also do a 300-point list with six as well. So it's all sorts of options, and the ones with generals in are slightly different. So I'm pretty sure I've ended up with six somehow along the line, just either two.
So what are the other armies you can make out of it? Because, Adam, you mentioned about two of them, and I think a couple of others mentioned other names.
Well, you can split with the Biblicals. What I would say, to split into two, you've got the Iron Age stuff, which is the Assyrian, so it's based around the four horse heavy chariot. So just go through the list and see what can have the four horse heavy chariot, and then you get the other stuff, and quite a lot of the other stuff is the same, and then you might need to get some specialist troops. And then the other one that you say you don't like is the Late Bronze Age, which is the two horse bow arm chariot, where you can get an awful lot of armies amount of that, because they all, it's like Harry Maternian, Syrian, they all look sort of like very similar chariots with a load of lads dragged along to sort of like do the cooking.
But don't they look quite different though?
Yeah, so there's two.
That's the two types.
You've got the Iron Age one based around a four horse chariot. Have a look. And then you've got the Late Bronze Age one.
No, I get those two differences with the different chariots. I'm just saying the different armies with the four horse chariot, Mark.
They might do, but firstly, no one's completely sure what people dressed in. And then quite often, so changing the sort of like Sargonid Assyrians to Babylonians, the chariots are basically the same, because the Babylonians followed the Assyrian military model.
So the, like guard, the Assyrian Tan and Ugat sort of thing.
Yeah, so the guard troops are the same. Now, for the Babylonians, you've probably got to bring along a lot more bow, because the Babylonians were... So that's the extra bit that you order to... put it out to that. For the not the Ugrits. Who said, well, I can't remember the name again.
Uratu.
Sounding
like Dick and Bob here.
Yeah. I think the list says
and Uvavu,
the Uratu. I think the list says that they use more cav. So you'd have the same core troops, because they use the same type of chariots and the same guard troops, but they brought along sort of like a lot more cav. So you buy a few more cav and then you can sort of like roll it out into them.
I think with the sound of this.
Then I think with the is it the Babylonians, you end up drifting into the early Achaemenid Persians. So you can use sort of Sparabara for some of their troops as well.
Really?
You're halfway to an Achaemenid Persian army. And there's also
the Babylonians have sort of like the medium for mixed bow shield.
Mixed bow shield, which is neat.
Ah, so. And the Babylonians have my favourite bottle of wine, the Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you get him as a, which is a brilliant name, and you get him as a strategist, and you get to play Dreadnought Babylon music as you sort of like paint them. So it's all good, really.
Yeah, you can do it.
I have plenty in armies, so I can charge people with camels.
Early period would look the same because they all came from the Caucasus and they were called Marianu. So they were all very similar. If you've got Mitanni, Hittite, any of those armies, the only one, the Egyptians were different because they wore kits. But the later heavy chariots, Assyrian chariots will do for Hebrew, Urartu, you know, you could use them for the Canaanite, Ugarit armies as well. So they were.
No. What I would definitely say though is steer away from getting a Hebrew army on sole basis that I know it would wind up handy, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Good army.
Well, the Hebrews could be allies of the Assyrians, which means they can have four more extra heavy chariots in the army.
Double up.
Everybody needs four more extra heavy chariots. So
absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Oh, Peter does, anyhow.
Yeah, so Peter.
Yeah,
so
Peter, like elephants, can't have enough.
So you spent a week gluing your own fingers together and thinking about what you're going to be doing shopping. Did the guy from Khorasan give you any hints about how the whole, you know, international postage malarkey customs duty works?
He's got a whole thing worked out on how you actually put it forward, how you actually structure it with. For it, how it comes across and everything else. So he briefs you all that when you put the order in. He gives you all instructions. So he emails you instructions about the best way to do it and everything else. He's worked it out quite well to make it the most efficient way possible for people who are ordering, to reduce the pain of stuff coming in from the US, for example.
You see, so, he's quite desperate to have UK orders at the moment. He's worried about us all disappearing.
Yeah,
so, I think a lot of internationals have seen a drop-off in orders from the UK.
Conversely, a lot of UK have seen drop-off of orders from the EU.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. This means war. Well, look, Peter, we'll all have a go and have a think and see what we want to chip in on this order then, and scour the Khorasan catalogue. But Tamsin, what about you? How's been your week? Have you finished the teeny tiny people and started going beyond prep on the paras?
I haven't gone any further on the paras, but still going on the teeny tiny 1/285th scale.
Oh, that's what we all want. Yes, a proper scale.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I can see, actually, because they are, you know, 15 wattsits bigger than 1/300th scale. Definitely. Mm. You can definitely see the difference.
Yeah,
there.
You can tell the difference between sort of Bacchus and Heroics and Ross.
Yep. That guy appears to actually have a visible beard that kind of goes round his mouth and stuff.
Yes, yeah, so I have got beards on a few of these, yeah.
Yeah. But he looks like a member of the band. It might be Robbie Robertson. Okay. All right.
Yeah, so the Confederate cavalry and generals are done, and
that was a really nice bold blue on those saddle cloths and things. Was there a particular colour you used for that? It just really jumped out quite well.
Vallejo dark blue. I can't remember.
Sometimes you don't need the actual number.
Sometimes with Vallejo, when you get the label, it says dark blue. Sometimes it says intense blue.
Okay.
Or just blue.
Right, okay. So it's a Vallejo blue then. That looked kind of neat. All right.
So on the paint table now, I've got dismounted cavalry, artillery, and some guns and limbers.
Okay. So how are you going to base them? Is there a base size or a basing thing? Because six, you know, basing, we talked a while ago about basing, well, but six mil is quite small.
Regiments will be on 60 by 60.
So how many you know, cavalrymen are you going to be putting on a 60 by 60? And are you just putting them in a cloud 14. Or in a 14 and putting them in a formation or
I have done, yes.
Okay. Is it sort of what, line abreast or a flying wedge or something like that? Or
yeah, so it's how I've done them in the past.
All right. So looking at that, so they're clustered together in the centre of the base in kind of two ranks of six with a couple of leaders in front, and then some are turning away or something like that.
Yeah,
then
I did some in a column. I did some going sort of off on a slant. So yeah.
Wow. Okay. The proper little formation then, and individual commanders with cap badges and all sorts of things. That's that's super cute. Really super cute.
One got yellow hair.
There might be one in there that's blonde. It's probably statistically likely. No, those really bold colours work really well on those tiny figures. It's
yeah, cap badges pick out quite nicely, don't they?
Over cap badges, yeah.
Yeah, definitely makes a difference.
And am I right in thinking, Tamsin, that you use some ridiculously fine grain special sand or something to base those?
I can't remember what sand I used on those. I think I did it as a mix of what's described as silver sand, some general sort of Wilco bird sand, and some bit of bird grit as well.
You're not highly specific into any particular breed of bird. It's not got to be a budgerigar between 0 to 6 months or something like that. No.
No.
Okay.
No. Well, because it's American Civil War, maybe they're parrots.
Ouch.
Ouch. Oh, yeah, I had to think about that. I knew it was going to be terrible, but it did take a little bit of thought. So it did fit together quite well. Well done, Andy. Another early appearance for the famous music.
Thank God we got that out of the way.
Yes, we got that over there nice and early. Okay. Well, interesting enough, I've actually had a horse week as well, really. I've made a start on these museum Thracians. They're not marketed as Thracians. They're sort of Scythian and Greek-like horse that I'm painting up as as Thracians to turn my, I think, 12 elements of Thracian infantry into a proper army by adding some cavalry to it. And it's been kind of a combination of trying to make the riders look like the Thracian infantry I painted about 7 or 8 years ago, which are kind of slightly sort of block colours with a really, really faint wash, but then trying to do the horses like my new kind of horse trick of painting in the coat to arms colors with the new replaced tops on them, and then doing a series of washes and then matte varnishing them. So there's some kind of rows of horses, four horses on a stick. And actually these museum figures, there's more variety than once you actually start painting the detail. There's actually a bit more variety in them than there's more and less actually. There's more variety in the individual poses between bareheaded and bald-headed and cap wearing and the bows at an angle up or down or across or whatever. There seems to be a bit more variety like that than I thought. However, what strikes me now particularly is they're all glued to lollipop sticks on my desk here. Because they're one piece castings, the poses are quite linear. There's nobody with arms out to the side or shooting to the side. They're all shooting or throwing the spear or whatever at different angles, but all doing it forwards or backwards. So I think they'll fit very neatly onto normal cavalry bases or whatever, but I think the light horse will have to be put at a bit of an angle, because in that same way that museum are kind of, just looking in sort of one way, they're a little bit like that, but they're really, really nice figures. And I think they will match quite well with the painting with the Zeiston Thracian infantry that I've got. And I've also started painting up a few of the Zeiston Persian cavalry that I've got as well, which, I think, Dave, you've had this, wish for Zeiston to make some early Persian cavalry, but those later Persian cavalry are just fantastic. They're so detailed and so well cast. And I just wonder is there really any difference between the early and the late cavalry at this scale that's meaningful?
The later ones look more like Greek, if that makes sense. I mean, basically, they've done the later Achaemenid army in complete, but they're working on the early Achaemenid. They've done all the infantry. I've got enough infantry from the early Achaemenid. Yeah.
But what would be different about early Achaemenid cavalry to their later Achaemenid cavalry? Is there any meaningful difference?
I think they'll have less armour, less linen armour. I think the later ones have got more Greek-style tergias and linen armour sort of thing.
Yeah.
You said, have you got the pack of the generals?
I've got a pack of those generals from Dave Allen. I did a dodgy deal with him over WhatsApp and shipped them in. But those are really, really nice figures as well.
The Greek helmet is a really good thing. And also the ones with the kind of barding around the legs, they're really nice figures. I mean, I've actually mixed them in a bit with other figures as well, with the Greek helmet and things.
Yeah, no, but by the end of this, I should have 12 bases of those different cavalry. I think some of them are like Paphlagonians and some are colonist cavalry and stuff like that. But I'm just mixing them all together and doing kind of different colours. And I'm trying to convince myself not to paint the Persians with contrast paints, because I think that's almost a little bit too easy to get that sort of silky effect. You know, I did it on the 28mm Arabs, which was grand, but I feel I can probably, if I go contrast, I'll be going contrast to get that silky effect. But with the Persians, I almost want to paint patterns on.
I'm confused. Yeah. What's wrong with making it easy?
Yeah, because I also really want to paint. You're right.
Great for doing the silky stuff. Yeah. Why make it hard for yourself?
But these are really nice figures, and I would quite like to force myself to paint patterns on them. You know, on the edging or stripes or things like that, because there's some really good.
But you can do that with the contrast things. You paint it with the contrast, then you do the edging on it anyway.
It's edging, but it's stripes. You know, I'm. It's almost forcing myself to do different techniques, really. So, and otherwise, I fear I might sort of forget how to do the other stuff.
But aren't you overcomplicating something that's actually? I mean, I've used those paints as well for painting Persians and that sort of thing, and it's almost as though they're designed for it. Why overcomplicate?
No, I'm definitely overcomplicating it. I'm overcomplicating deliberately to keep my hand in with different painting techniques, I think.
So, Tim, I'm going to actually buy a pack of Highland Napoleonic infantry for you, so you can go and paint some kilts then, if you want to get complicated.
Look, I've done kilts in 15mm. We talked about that last week. That's all well and done, but this is kind of like proto-kilt doing on some of these Persians, just to kind of keep it there. And then I've done a bit of, probably a little bit too much of inking on a unit of 10mm Napoleonic guards, Imperial Guard as well. And I'm getting there with some of those 28mm Thracian conversions, which again is kind of a little bit of a cloak pattern thing that I've got to do some sort of cloaks with stripes and spots and things like that will be there. And I've just about finished rebasing. I've only got one more unit to do of rebasing all of the hoplites as well. So
that's what you want to do, Tim, with the Khorasan order, is order some sort of like South American Incas or something, and you can do like leopards and all the lurid colours like that. So that almost like were some of the colours Simon had on his Ratmobile.
Well, you know, the Incas,
you can get truly lurid then.
The Incas is a whole different kettle of fish, which is. I think I might have mentioned this last week. I've been doing some stuff for Ian at Fighting 15s to try and help him design ready-made army packs to kind of ADLG army in a box size.
Oh, right.
And, I think you can effectively do an army for 40 quid, Bosch, done about 130 figures. So
great
it
value.
It works out cheaper than the or the same price as those PSC plastics, but for metals from some of the Fighting 15 stuff. So hopefully soon, because I've been saying to him, of all the different ranges, my theory, in fact, it's maybe test it out on you guys. And my theory is all of us as wargamers look at Aztec, Maya and the rest of it in any set of wargames rules and go, oh, it'd be really cool to have one of those, but it's going to be rubbish and it's going to be a lot of painting and I'm going to paint an awful lot of figures, and I'm going to put them on the table, and they're going to be rubbish. So there's something I'm going to do first, but one day I want one of those. Now, in ADLG, you can, and also actually, if you play one, you in an older set of rules, you'd be saying the games are going to take 3.5 hours. I'm going to get beaten 4 times in a weekend, and it's going to take 13 hours of my life up with this not particularly good army. But in ADLG, if it's 100 figures and it's a 2-hour game and you can play a 1-day competition, you're not actually spending much money. You're not spending the painting time. You're still putting them on the table. And if they get beaten, you've only wasted 2 hours of your life, not 3.5. So I think there's probably a real sweet spot for these sort of Aztec South American armies in ADLG, all in one go.
Well, that was your theory, yours and my theory, like when we did the samurai armies, because we thought to do that in Fog AM or Fog R or whatever, you're up for 300-400 figures and a fair whack of Wonga. It's one of those armies we've all wanted to do. So when you're putting on 20 or 30 bases of, because you have to have a few extras, it became a lot more affordable because you can afford to do it. It's, you know, it's a few weeks of painting, something to do in the evenings.
But Simon, why take it to Worlds?
because it was based on Tim's and my theory of you go to competition with a new shiny painted army that you've never played on the table before.
And that showed because you didn't know the bloody rules for Impetuous against them.
I thought you'd gone off sightseeing because I didn't see you for the whole weekend because you're off in the other room with the the DBM players or the Fog players?
I was only in the room of shame for 4 out of the 7 games. I did get back into the normal room by the end of the competition.
But that was just for drinks.
Yeah, and it was Rome anyway, wasn't it? But the idea of buying an Aztec or a Maya or a Zapotec or a Telexican army for just like one click, 40 quid.
One of them has pikes, doesn't it?
I think possibly, yeah. I think that might be the...
Tenantecs, I think, have pikes. I remember Clive telling me, but I know next to nothing about all these armies and I'm not sure how I'd paint them. I find it actually more entertaining to turn up at a competition not knowing my armies yet and only finding out during the process.
Yeah, but that's become quite a regular thing, hasn't it? My theory is, and it'll be interesting to see how it do, that these Aztec armies might do particularly well for ADLG because there's a lot of latent interest in an easy way to own and use one of those sorts of armies. So I helped him put together some lists, and I think they're going to go on sale in the next week or so. So,
well, I like the Texica. Yeah, because I can get a medium knight impact elite, so it's like they got me sold then.
Yeah, that's your perfect one, isn't it? That's just the best single unit in that whole thing. So I've been doing a bit of that over the course of it. So that's been kind of the computery stuff alongside a bit of the painting. But hopefully by next week, these Thracian cavalry will be painted and based up. And then I'll have to just order some more infantry to kind of go with the set. But this means war. This means war. So just going round. Dave, what about you? What's been on your painting table this week?
Still looking at the gentleman of the 17th century. I'm on the final 6-pack, which is the Dutch Garde de Voet. And their little blue jackets with yellow trousers and yellow cuffs and stuff. I'm actually sitting there doing them at the moment. I've been wrapped up in interviews trying to get back into work this week, so it's all been a bit hit and miss. But I was going to make a few comments. With the Aztecs, if you go onto Amazon, there's a Duncan Head. Yep. Yeah, Duncan Head did all the WRG books. He did a few for one of the war games manufacturers on other weird subjects like Central Asian armies of the Renaissance and things like that. But he's got one on the conquest of South America, and he does all the Incas and the Aztecs. It's a fantastic book. It's really good. It's got the little line drawings.
Okay.
All the WRG books, I recommend that. So that's good. And we're going to do a podcast on the Aztecs, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's on our list of army list podcasts, is to do the Aztecs and all the other ones, to try and see if there is any ways of making half decent lists out of them to fight anything else other than each other. But
it's really good fun if they're all facing off against each other.
But it's certainly going to be colourful for sure.
Yeah, some weird combinations if they're in the right subjects and that.
Yeah, I mean, we had I think it was the last Burton's doubles. We were at the sports centre. There was a guy there. It was when I think it was the second year of doing ADLG, and there was a guy there who brought a doubles army worth of Aztecs, and it was a stunning army because you could basically fill this entire table. And we were able to turn the army sideways and just come down lengthwise on the table of just medium swordsman impetuous. He had an Aztec pyramid with someone being sacrificed on the top and various other cool things. He had all the Aztec pumas, the very multicolored lions and dragons, all that stuff. And just from a sheer visual effect of this ultra colorful army coming storming down at you, the guy said, you know, I painted it because I've always wanted to have it. And I'm really happy to actually get on the table for the first time in decades. And it looked beautiful. And he actually got about two out of four wins out of it. So he was even more stoked.
No, we're certainly
Jaguar and Eagle Warriors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Peter, you're sold already, aren't you? Come on, you know this makes sense.
Well, you see, the one I always fancied to him was one of the actual North American Indian ones.
Okay.
Mound Builders.
Yeah. Because okay. I do like the South American ones because they've got great colours and everything else. But I just like the... because some of my family's up from that way. So trying to do some of those.
Yeah. No, I think Well, Adam, you just come off mute. Were you shouting at someone else in the other room or trying to concentrate?
Yeah, I was just going to say to Peter, I think the Aztecs had the Eagle and Jaguar Warriors, but I think if you look at the Tlaxcans' military history, they had the Badger Warriors. So you might want to do them. Lots of people.
Oh, fantastic.
Black and white.
Badgers. Oh, brilliant.
And there's probably a contrast paint that you just paint on that comes up with black and white stripes, I imagine, just to make life really easy for you.
It's called two-tone.
Two-tone.
Pluck a few hairs out and just do it.
Yeah, do the scenery with all that sort of stuff. Okay. All right, that's an interesting one. Just trying to think, we go around to Andy. What about you? Has there been skeletons this week?
Yes, finished the whole skeleton army. Everything, monsters, leaders, the whole works. Apart from one figure, which I'm going to definitely buy from alternative armies, they've got a 28 mil skeleton general on a horse. So I'm going to buy one of them as an army commander.
On a horse? That's going to be quite a size, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, it's kind of that kind of thing that you do. You have 28 mil general in charge of a smaller scale army. You can tell he's a commander.
Honestly, I do that, but I generally make sure that they're an infantryman because I've tried horses and they're just too big. But then again, if it's a skeleton on a skeleton horse, that's probably
But I mean, you know, it's gonna look spectacular.
It's look skeletonian, isn't it?
Does
that mean you've actually started a new project then?
Yes, I'm now sort of I'm putting on sticks and undercoating the basically most of the museum stuff I bought recently. So there's a unit of hoplites for which you kindly sent me the shield patterns. Thank you. I've got one unit of Indian warriors and about six units of Greek and Scythian cavalry. Again, primarily for my Thracian army. So I shall probably put them towards the back of the queue, wait and see what you do with yours so I get an idea as to how to do it properly.
All right, okay. So that's bizarre. So we're both putting together a Thracian army as we speak.
Well, yes, I mean, but I was disappointed you said you've got 12 units of Thracian infantry. That's just not enough for a Thracian army.
Oh, no, I've got another, thinking I need to buy another four, and I've actually bought another four already from Dave Allen again, or from his secret stash. So yeah. I will end up with something close to 20, I think, which
I think you can only have... I think you can only have four proper cavalry in the army, and you can have quite a bit of light cavalry, but that's, you know, I'm not a huge fan of lots of that.
Yeah, the Getae, and Getae horse archers makes it quite an interesting different army. So, no, that will be an interesting one. Okay, then, so I think we've... Oh, Adam,
sorry,
another one.
Tim, Just before we go on, because got a special announcement. I was going to leave it until the end of the show, but then I realised that probably no one's listening by that time, so it's probably best to do it at the beginning. Special Mad Axeman exclusive. Just an announcement that on Saturday, the 31st of July and the 1st of August, there will be an ADO competition at Entoyment in Bournemouth.
Ooh, that's been booked in.
So,
the seaside. Brilliant.
Put it in your diaries.
Excellent.
What I'm going to do, because what I want to do is give everyone the chance to play with whatever toys that they've painted or whatever toys they want. So I want to do a 15 and 25 mil competition. So as long as we can get six people in each, that's five games.
Yeah.
So just to check, I'll probably put on Facebook, would you come? If you would come, what scale would you want to do? Or would you not, would you willing play any?
Pretty fine.
Have a look on that for Facebook in the next few days. And please, if you would be thinking of coming, answer. And then I'll be sending out information in the next week or two about where to book and buy tickets.
So
fantastic stuff.
Are we able to book accommodation somewhere? Are the hotels not open yet? I don't know what the
trip is. I think they're open. That's why end of July, beginning of August, either something's gone wrong and then it's not happening anyhow. Yeah. Or hotels are kind of open, aren't they? That was my understanding.
Yeah. 31st of June, allegedly, is when the hotel should start to open properly. So July should be fine, yeah.
Yeah.
Hotels are getting doing sailor return because Tim and I are going to the competition in York and we've done that, haven't we, Tim? We've just got tickets you can get refunded.
Yeah, get a ticket you can sort of cancel a month before or a few weeks before. And certainly I know that self-catering holiday accommodation is booking up very, very quickly at the moment on the south coast of England. That's one of my other specialist subjects. But that's a different podcast. Maybe I'll splice in an advert at some point, at this point in the podcast, and put on a false Devon voice, which that's probably a bad idea, isn't it?
The English Riviera. Capture the moment. Seize the fun. Yay! And just relax. For a great time, anytime, book online now.
Book your self-catering holiday for this summer in glorious Devon now on brixhamholidayhomes.com. And a word to the wise, the captain's cottage is the one to check out.
This means war.
So look, that's covered in excessive detail all the painting that's gone on this week, and even a talk of transatlantic shopping, which is a rare new development for us. But also in the field of new developments, we're sort of starting to get, this is episode four that we're about to come up to of our new feature of I'm sorry, I think you're an arse, and it's sort of building up ahead of steam. So without further ado, let's fire up the theme music and go into our new feature. Coming up next on Mad Axeman Radio, it's I'm Sorry, I Think You're an Arse, the antidote to informed discussion shows. At the piano this week is Scott Joplin, and your chairman is Sir Humphrey Humphreyson. Hello and welcome everybody to this week's edition of I'm Sorry, I Think You're an Arse. You join us this week from the Grecian Fantasy Theatre in Over Peover in East Cheshire. Just a little to the east sits the town of Peover Heath, and a few miles to the south nestles tranquil Badger Bank. Located in the north of England, visitors who climb to the top of a nearby moor are greeted with a view encompassing seven different counties. And on a clear day, it's sometimes even possible to catch sight of Leeds off in the distance, despite the many prominent warning signs erected advising against this. So Adam, I think you just want to wade into it.
Okay, so what I want to talk about this week is people that talk about and complain about the greying of the hobby. And that's a really obscure term, but you all know what it means because you've all heard of it. And this is people, and what they mean is they mean several things. Firstly, they mean wargamers are getting older, By wargamers, I'm talking specifically about historical figure gamers, okay? Wargamers are getting older. This is a bad thing because as we get older, we all do that final journey on our own that we all have to do at some point. And there aren't younger people coming in to sort of like carry on the wargaming traditions. So wargaming will die out. So then they mean, what can we do to stop this, right? I think they're talking nonsense. And the reason why they're talking nonsense is three main reasons. Firstly, growing a hobby, wargamers aren't getting older. I'll talk about that in a minute. Secondly, even if they are getting older, that's not a bad thing. It might actually be a good thing, to be perfectly honest, okay? And thirdly, even if it was a bad thing, the people that want to do something about it can't, so they might as well just forget about it, okay? So firstly, okay. Growing a hobby, wargaming's getting older and wargaming's dying out. This just isn't true. So when I look about sort of like all the different figures you can buy now, it's like, as I talked last week about all the different so-called scales, there are huge amounts of new war games companies coming all the time, huge amounts of new war games figures. And I'm talking just about historical figures. You know what I mean? The choice is growing. There's lots and lots of more. So if wargamers were literally dying off, there would be less companies, there would be less figures for sale. But wargaming as a hobby seems to be expanding. I don't know the figures, but I can just look at the different ranges, and there's definitely more. So when people complain about the graying of the hobby, what they actually mean is me and my mates are getting older. And actually, that happens to everyone. So I don't care whether you and your mates are getting older, because so am I. Okay. Second thing, it's a good thing that wargamers are getting older. Young people should not be playing war games. Okay, young people should not be playing historical war games, because you've got to want to play games, you've got to want to paint figures, and you've got to want to do the research and reading, which, to be frank, is like being at school. Okay, this is an old person's hobby. Now, children, I don't mind children playing war games. Okay, Peter, your lads play war games, don't they? And you might take them to. Yeah, and they love it, and you might take them to competitions, and that'll be really good, and it'd be good to see them there. And if my boy and girl, if when they get a bit older, they want to come to competitions or come to shows as well, I would be honoured, and I would be so pleased for them to come. That would be brilliant. However, how old are your children?
14 and 16 at the moment.
14 and 16, right. That's perfect, right? If, however, when they're 20 and 22, they're still playing war games, right, that's a bad thing. If when they're 20 and 22, they get a choice of to do three things at the weekend, right? Three different choices at the weekend when they're 20 and 22. One, come to Bournemouth and do parasurfing with your mates for the weekend. And it's like sort of like surfboard, and you've got that kite parachute thing. And I've seen them down the seafront when I walk down the seafront, and they go really fast, and I hope they bump into each other, and they never do, but it looks brilliant. Okay, so if your lads had that choice of that to do, fine. Second choice, go to Amsterdam, 48 hour non-stop ecstasy fueled techno party, or whatever drugs and music kids do today. Okay, now I'm not saying doing drugs is big and clever, but I'm saying it's possibly quite fun. And looking around the screen, there are some people that probably fill you in with the details, all the sweaty, gurning details, okay? We can talk about that off air. That's choice number two. Or choice number three, go to some market town in the arse end of Somerset to have a 15-mil feudal ADLG competition for the weekend, right? If they're their three choices and they choose...
But Adam, you're talking as though they're mutually exclusive.
No, you can have four weekends in a month.
I think if you do go to the arse end of Somerset, that you're not going to, you know, play war games in the weekend and then go to an all night acid house techno rave in the evening. The highlight of your evening.
No, but you can do on the next weekend.
If they choose St Mary's Thrumpington in a scout hall, right, playing toy soldiers, you as a father failed them. Okay, there is only one possible reason, one decent excuse for them to go and play ADLG in the arse end of Somerset. And that's because it's their 21st birthday coming up, and they want a car and they've got to spend some time with the grumpy old tightwad to soften them up so they can get the present they want. I'll take that as an excuse for 20-year-olds to be playing war games. But if anyone in their 20s is in a pub on a Saturday night and they look up and they see themselves sat up a table with us, they really, really need to think about their life choices, okay? Because I am roughly my own age, and even I find me boring, okay? So if you're in your 20s, you should be out there trying to cop off with a large variety of interestingly shaped girls or boys, whatever you want, I don't care. You should be doing anything except sitting in a pub talking about the relative merits of 25 mil plastic warlord versus Victrix ancient Romans, okay?
You're wasting your life. Adam, right, so... Have you been over to Birmingham for the Games Expo?
No, I've never been. I've been to Birmingham once, never going again.
Right. So the Birmingham Games Expo in the Midlands has like several thousand people and a whole multitude of games. The historical one was tiny, tiny.
Yeah. No. Don't stop. This is what I mean.
I'm talking. You're listening. You're the one saying that. There was so many different games there.
Sorry, you don't have the authority.
And types of games and...
Yeah, no, bollocks, right? Because this is my rant. And as I said, I'm talking about historical...
And board games and a whole mix of...
Yeah, this is my rant, and I'm talking about historical wargaming, okay? Old people play historical wargames, and that's absolutely fine. I don't have a problem with that, okay? Because it's something that older people do. That's fine. Because the third thing is the whole, we want to get younger people involved in historical wargaming. Okay, people sit around and say, how can we recruit more young people to do historical wargaming? Okay, now, if you're having that conversation, it means you can't. Because you all know wargamers, yeah? Now, think of your average wargamer, okay? Recruiting people into hobby, you've got to sort of like talk to them, enthuse them, and sort of like share your passions, okay, and use social skills. You all know wargamers. Think of your average wargamer and think half of them have got less social skills than that, okay? Yeah. Now, you might say, but half of them have got more social skills than that, and that's true, but we are working off a very low base, okay, because looking around the screen here, there are some people here that when I look at you, I think out of all the wargamers I know, you are more fitted than most to operate in normal society and talk to normal people, okay? That's a good... Although I understand I might be biased, okay? Because I know you're my friends, and I'm willing to get over the visual impact and I'm willing to ignore the smell, okay? But overall, you're more fitted than most to talk to normal people. But most wargamers aren't very good at selling what they're interested in. Some are, okay? Now, I've talked about sort of like this competition at Toyman. The chap that runs at Toyman, Pete, he's a nice chap. He tells not inappropriate jokes. He listens to people when they talk. He's actually very good at enthusing people and bringing people into a shop and selling wargames as a hobby, okay? So we can split wargamers into two. Those that are actually recruiting people into the hobby and those that are talking about how we should recruit people into the hobby. And if you're one of the people talking about how we should, it means you can't. So instead of worrying about it, instead of going on about the graying of the hobby, you should just go back, go with your mates, get used to the fact that you're getting old, swap those amusing anecdotes about that funny thing that happened to you at Sheffield Triples in 1985, right? And don't worry about it.
It was 86, actually. On.
Yeah, but how old were you in 1985? How old were you in 1985? That's the question.
It's not how old was I, because I'm not a boring old fart sitting there going, I'm worried about the graying on hobby. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about all you other ones, okay? So don't worry about the graying on the hobby. The hobby's doing fine. Okay, when you say, I'm worried about the growing hobby, what you're actually saying is, I'm worried I'm getting old and I've got this existential fear about dying and I just want to talk to young people to give me a sense that life might go on, okay? Now, that's a fear that everyone faces. Wargaming or not.
Adam, no, come on. Isn't that actually a question of, it's not that, it is existential, but it's an existential fear of you won't be able to sell your armies on eBay because there won't be enough people by the time you get into your 80s. to pick them up.
Well, it's not so much selling your armies. I think most war gamers I know, as we get older, you do actually worry about what's going to happen to them. And it's like, it's basically, it's like, I've given instructions to Francesca. If I die, just give it all to Tim and he'll sort it out. Don't worry about it. You know what I mean? So I think there is, and you might even get some cash. So there is that, but it's like, yeah, people are worrying about, oh God, it's like, oh, it's great. And no, it's just you, and it's you, and you're getting old, and nobody cares about you. It's you, you do, and your wife might, if you're lucky, and your children might, if you bought them a car for their 21st birthday party, but I don't, and sort of like no one else does. So just forget about it and just have fun playing with your toy soldiers. Right, what's the next subject?
I'm going to chime in here. This topic, growing of a hobby, from what I can make out, having read various threads on forums and so on, people have been talking about the growing of a hobby since I was in nappies.
Yeah. It's never happened, has it?
It hasn't. And as you say, people who the increasing range of manufacturers and figures that are available. If historical wargaming was dying out, who the hell is buying them? Because companies don't start up unless there's a market for them. And all these companies starting up, selling historical figures, somebody's buying them. And they must be buying more because you've got more companies that existing than ever before. So yeah, it's
maybe
not like...
maybe actually almost maybe this is an issue about perception. It's kind of, you know, if a 28 mil plastic figure falls in the woods, does anybody notice if the spear breaks off or something like that? And if you think the whole world for the last 12 months has been, every single person in the world has been pushed into their own house and locked in, and become much more useful or used to living life on their own, or living life with literally no social contact. So basically the entire population of the country has been being trained in how to be most wargamers. Because again, you know, one of the things that you see is people who go to events or competitions or put on display games or chat to each other on forums, that's the visible active part of the hobby. That's sort of almost the outreach part of the hobby. But every single, you know, event that you go to or something, you will see stuff. In fact, Heinz Figures and a few other people on eBay basically make all their money by picking up collections of vast numbers of usually dreadfully painted stuff that somebody who has no contact with the outside world whatsoever has decided that they are going to collect at home, the one-to-one scale British Army of the Rhine in 27 mil from 1982 to 83. And then they're going to pitch that against an Austrian battalion from 1742 in a life-size recreation of something made out of bits of soggy cardboard and then covered in cheap railway flock. And there's these enormous volumes of figures of all obscure nonsense that gets bought by someone and you never see it. So the whole hobby must be a huge iceberg of people buying weird stuff and then locking it up and never painting it and then never putting it on table against another person. And that must be so much of it. You know, you remember last year when I was talking about those
that's why sheds were invented, for people to put stuff like that in.
Yeah, exactly. It's all sheds. How many sheds? And the British shed industry has been doing fantastically well during Brexit. I've seen
specially designed to hold miniatures.
Exactly, specially designed to hold miniatures. So the idea
apparently there have been a lot of people playing games. Gaming has become a new thing, mainly board games, I think, for families. But the idea of playing games, rolling dice, and doing that as an evening's entertainment has expanded. So from there, it's probably not a huge step to doing that with miniature figures, whether it's fantasy or historical.
Isn't that
like games experts?
Rights in people returning to scale modelling.
Yeah.
Tech Museum had a video a couple of weeks ago, sort of about people's Velvet Scale modelling, and they had sort of Chris Barry, I Rimmer.
Yeah, and he's young, isn't he? Well, maybe.
50s.
Yeah.
So, Adam, I think the key thing that you were saying it's an arse about is more that people are complaining about it. You know, if you can do something about it, then do it. If not, stop complaining about it and just enjoy.
Yeah, and even if you can do something about it, but you can't be arsed, then don't bother. It's just like, just it's your hobby, you know what I mean? It's not a
just gift. Just embrace to the it.
Playing with toy soldiers is not some sort of gift to the future. It's you doing something that you enjoy, okay? So enjoy it.
Because, live in the moment is what you're saying.
Going back to the point I was making, most people, the vast majority of this people in this, you know, if you read any forum, there will always be a thread of competition gamers are the devil, and that's a terrible way to play it. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's
hey!
that's a different rant. But
I've got my tried. You know,
we are people who go out to competitions and interact with other people, whereas most war gamers just literally stay at home in their own shed and possibly interact with two or three other people at most. So this, you know, mythical new blood coming into the hobby is not going to matter to these people because they've only got three people they either game with anyway, or they game on their own, surely. So I think there's even more to it. It doesn't matter because most people do not interact with large numbers of people. And as long as there's more companies and more figures for everybody to buy, which, as Tamsin, you say, there clearly is, what would new people coming into the hobby actually bring? Now, I think, Andy, you said there's a lot of gaming going on, and there are clearly
I heard on the radio or something.
Gaming is becoming more socially acceptable. So that's more people who are partway along the road to potentially becoming...
You're basically calling it a gateway drug.
Yeah. It's a gateway drug. Board games are a gateway
Monopoly
drug.
Monopoly is a gateway drug. I can see it now.
Yeah,
it was the top out's fault.
Well, even you Doctor Who fans. My wife likes Doctor Who, and if there was a Doctor Who game with some Dalek figures and that, she'd probably think, "Oh, I might have a go at that."
But enough, there is.
Is that because she's got a crush on Peter?
I don't want gaming. I don't want historical figure gaming to become popular. Okay, it's like. I like the fact.
It's not elitist. You've had your round. Shut up.
It's the opposite of being elitist, okay? It's sort of like, it's a bit weird and a bit embarrassing, but when people find out, it gives me a little... It's like, when I was working in school, I did... It was in primary school, and I did after-school club, and I took Wings of Glory down. Okay, and it's like I had all my little like model planes, and all the kids were 10 or 11, and I sort of like slapped their fingers if they picked up by the plane and not by the base. But it's like they loved it, okay? They loved it. And all the other teachers came along and they had to look and they thought, oh, that looks quite good, but it's a bit weird, okay? And that was me. I was the one that had the sort of like the planes that were good and I was a bit weird, and that's fine. I'm happy with being a bit weird, okay? It's a weird hobby. The historical figure games are a weird hobby. It's also something
that if you show by example, your kids may follow, and you might get some pleasure from your kids vicariously, the same way I did for my son once, in that we're members of English Heritage, and they were doing an event once when my son was about four called Armies and Invaders of England, and it was down in Hastings Castle. So I was telling Nathan we were going down with another family, and he said, what's going to be there? There's going to be soldiers, like my French and my British. And he says, will there be any Prussians? And the feeling of pride you got from that was you just can't buy that kind of thing.
And he's never played since. When he was four.
Will there be any Prussians? Yeah. He then kind of lost his way a bit and got into fantasy and Warhammer and stuff. But, we still talk to each other. And you still...
Despite him being into fantasy.
That's very generous of you.
He says nice things about my painting every so often, so I put up with him.
Okay, so coming back to it then, Adam, we've heard a very comprehensive 3-point rant and a dissection of the theory of the issue that the greying of the hobby is a problem. So coming back to your core proposition here, it's the greying of the hobby isn't happening. If it is, it's not a problem, and
if it's a problem, you can't do anything about it anyhow. So don't worry about it.
So that's it. So look, let's go around the table here and say, and the answer is either Adam, I think you're an ass, or actually, I agree with you. So, Andy, what do you think?
I think I agree with him this week.
Peter?
I agree with him. It's like, if you're not doing something about it, shut up and just play. Have a laugh. If you are, then great. Get the kids playing.
Tamsin?
I agree with him.
You agree with him? David Russell Saunders, in your window?
I have to, unfortunately, say I thoroughly agree, with a caveat. Harrison Pierce is in his 20s, and he's probably one of the best war gamers we've got. So I think, I really hope
he's... Yeah, well, no, but he would still have more fun, sort of like eat out of his head in techno nightclub in Amsterdam, gurning away, wouldn't he?
To say the two aren't incompatible.
He does do that sometimes, actually. Well,
I can say the two are. I can say the two aren't compatible, because I might have done both, and they don't mix.
Certainly those weekends we've tried it, they don't mix very well, do they? No.
We all have stories. Petitions where there may have been, was it a German techno bar in
Koblenz?
Simon, people's wives might be listening. Stop talking.
Stop talking, yeah, stop
talking. We'd better not talk about Koblenz.
No, I mean, so, yeah, we don't talk about
it. We'd always have Koblenz.
So Simon, what do you think? What's your opinion on Adam?
On Adam or on the topic?
On the topic, on the proposition at question.
I agree with Adam. I think the hobby is great, but it's you're just seeing a different... because wargaming is now such a big spectrum, you're not having everyone just playing the one game. So when we talked about, when Peter was talking about the UK Board Games Expo, it was fantastic to see this complete broad spectrum of ages, from, you know, little four-year-old up to some grumpy old bastard in his 90s. There's so many different games. Yes, one particular thing is aging, because rather than everyone playing DBM, you know, second edition, you've now got the Games Expo. It was great to see, like, there's, was it 200-300 players playing X-Wing, 200-300 players playing Star Wars, 200-300 players playing something else. Then there was a Yu-Gi-Oh! Players. Then there was that board games. Then there was the other everything else. Yes, we were a little bit grayer, but that's fine. You know, it's a natural evolution. You start with something, you know, you start with Warhammer or whatever it is, but over time you get a bit more interested. You play historical or whatever. You know, it's just, yeah.
No, I must admit, I think I'm...
Can I change my opinion, please? Because thinking about it, I think that Adam is an ass for ranting about something we all agree with.
Oh,
that's a deep one.
Dangerous,
Yes, dangerous. But no, I think Simon, your point there is it, you know, I think the hobby is possibly graying, but I think that's because for, you know, when we were younger and came into it, we were people who liked a bit of military stuff and we liked playing games, and we found ancient wargaming because, or historical wargaming, because that was the only thing that existed that ticked those two boxes. If we'd started now, we probably would have gone, oh, bloody hell, there's a Star Wars game where you can fly X-Wings. I'll do that instead. So actually lots more people are finding gaming and tabletop gaming and not getting put off because it's not quite their thing. So the youngsters have got better options than historical wargaming. And it's only the ones who are actually genuinely interested in history are doing it. It's not people who are interested in gaming who are defaulting to historical wargames because it's the only thing that existed or could be found. So actually, I think the hobby, even just to define it as historical wargaming, is nonsense. So sadly, Adam, I think also I do agree with you as well on this one. It's quite remarkable.
I'm just going to point out that Simon and I have both played X-Wing.
Oh, I have as well. It's an all right game.
It's a great game.
And I've got Wings of War.
Yep.
And we've got Wings of War as well. Well, on that one, we will call in the theme music and fly off into the distance. Well, as the Andy joke of time hits the tumbleweed sound effect of destiny, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of I'm Sorry, I Think You're an Ass. We'll be back next week. look, with the I'm sorry, I think you're an arse theme music fading fantastically into the distance, we now move on to the somewhat briefer, I suspect, and less controversial. What have you been playing this week? And I think this is probably a list of me and you this week, Andy. And there's a link between the two, isn't there? So you, tell us about your game. Is this your regular transatlantic tabletop simulator game?
Yes, I had two games since we last podcasted, because we switched the day of the week. I had my weekly game this week with Dave Ray and lost that as well, although it was quite exciting, and I'll tell you briefly about that in a minute. But the game last week we did Hat In, which was Crusaders against Ayyubid, and of course you did a podcast on that, and unfortunately for me, Dave Ray had listened to the podcast and he chose
him. He was the listener.
He chose essentially your Crusader list. So I turned up for the battle with about 20 or 21 Ayyubid units, and he bloody 26 Crusaders lined up across the table. I couldn't get round the bastards.
Oh, right. So he went for my wall of rubbish then
Yes. I think it was about nine. Cavalry. Ten mediocre heavy spear. I think one or two of them were armored. Two mediocre bow, four crossbow, and I can't remember if they had pervisors. And then just one mounted command and a couple of lights. And I just, there was just no way around this wall of dross. And I got chased off the board and shot to bits. And your list works. So I
brilliant.
Reckon.
Well, I'll go back and record a coda then to the that list podcast and say that it's been battle tested and mine was obviously the best. That's good. I'm happy with that.
Yeah. So you can claim a victory in a game you didn't play. It's a very satisfying feeling, isn't it?
It works, I'll take any victory.
I once had that at Historicon in 2003. I was with a group of guys and we were
practicing. That's when you were much younger, wasn't it? Yeah, when everybody was younger.
Yeah, and before my part of the hobby got grey. And I used to play a game called PK in those days. I don't know if you know about the rule system, but anyway, there's a.
Oh, it's a game for youngsters, I think.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, this guy, Eric, was presenting a game on World War One in East Africa. So we had a practice game on the Wednesday night. Then on Wednesday, on the Friday, he was presenting it for real in the for members of the public. And it basically involved the British and Kenyans and Askaris and whatnots trying to cross a river and then drive off the Germans. And he had all sorts of fantastic terrain and kraals and crops and animals and, you know, some African wild animals in it. And as I walked past the table as the game just started, I just called out to Eric, "Have you told the British about the crocodiles?" And this carried on. An hour later, when I went past the table, the British hadn't moved across the river, because even though Eric tried to persuade them otherwise, I spooked them with the idea that they were going to be attacked by crocodiles if they waded into the river, and the Germans won. So I reckon that's a win for me in a game I didn't play. So, you know, I can understand the how you'd be feeling satisfied about the fact that Dave beat me with his Crusader army.
No, I think bluff and counter-bluff is a very big part of Sun Tzu's Art of War, so that definitely fits.
Yeah, that's right. And then Wednesday, Monday we did a... it was Angelud, which was Ilkhanid Mongols against Mamelukes. And I lost that game, but had I managed to capture his fortified camp the turn before the game ended, I'd have just beaten him. Had I captured his fortified camp on the turn of the game ended, it would have been a mutual. So even though I lost, I had chances to win or draw. So that was quite exciting.
Who was the
Mamelukes? I was the Ilkhanid Mongols. I decided to go with loads of light cavalry, and it didn't go too well. I hadn't worked out how to do that particularly well. And then next time we're doing Bannockburn, and I've got to be the English.
Civilization again.
Pardon?
Dave Ray saved civilization from the Mongols.
Well, he saved it for me, which is probably even better.
Egypt, and it got all the way through to Spain and up through England.
Yeah, we'd have made it to Basingstoke. Yeah, then what would have happened? Yeah.
Yeah, they probably would have got stuck on the one-way system around.
I don't think I've seen someone win with a light horse army yet.
No, well,
I thought about it with like Lithuanians or something for a laugh.
I think with an ADOG, light horse army has got some light horse 6-8 and then medium cav.
Yeah, because
light horse is my game of winning.
My game of the week, I actually played Tommy, young Tommy from Ireland, who's now got Tabletop Simulator, which is grand.
And, is he good at pinball?
Of course. And he was using a Carolingian army with a lot of charging, you know, impetuous or charging heavy cavalry and some spearmen. And to take a kind of historical opponent, I took Andalusian Arab. And I took it because it's Tabletop Simulator. I tried one of those, you know, the command of 5 or 6 light horse, just with a general, and then a block of spears, and then a block with a lot of cavalry and a lot of different medium foot as well to try and take advantage of some terrain. So it actually worked really well. I got a river down, which was what I wanted. And the theory with that is that your 5 or 6 light horse command becomes almost an on-table flank march and zips down the river and threatens to come across it. And I managed to push my medium foot, because I moved first, up and into this piece of terrain near the river as well, which, given his army was, you know, very, very good against mine in the open, but I kind of shoved a lot of my stuff down this one flank, and it got into a position at which it could sort of outflank his army. So whilst I was kind of pinning it to the front, just pushing through the terrain with medium spearmen and some bowmen and other bits and pieces, really fixed it from the front and managed to start wrapping it up. So I took, you know, quite some damage in there, but having someone's done it against me once, having a command that is entirely light horse, once you get up to 5 or 6 of them, it is quite a lot, because it's wider than anything else that you're going to find on the flank, and the overlaps and the chance to get in the rear and the fixation it puts on other people's command and control dice, because they have to leave troops behind to stop you just, you know, marching round their rear and eating their baggage and coming to the rear of their army, is actually quite a significant drag on their command and control. Whereas 5 light horse and a embedded ordinary general, it's kind of 30 points and it's kind of nothing really for what it can achieve. So it was interesting to try that out and give it a go. So I might throw that Andalusian army, and it's another one of my list of trying to tick off all the Arab armies and put all of them on table, sort of real table or virtual, and it works surprisingly well. It really made me, you know, remember how using terrain and using different troop types in numbers can suddenly sort of sometimes catch people out. So yeah, no, an interesting tabletop simulator game. And I think, Adam, we've found out that there's also Malifaux now on Tabletop Simulator as well, which will be interesting if we can actually try and get a game of that and try and remember how to play it.
I might even buy Tabletop Simulator because of it. But yeah, no, that's because I haven't played Malifaux in over a year now.
And well over a year.
If not more, yeah. And it's just a really good game. So yeah I've been well. This means war.
In fact, talking of games, both Andy, you and me have both received our copies of the new Lardy's rules, haven't we? O Group as well.
Yeah.
And me.
And you as well, Tamsin. Yeah, sorry, 3 of us then. So what's kind of first impressions? I don't know, Andy or Tamsin, do you want to start?
Well, I
felt it quite playable.
Hmm.
I thought it was quite good to read. One thing I'm not clear on is, if you roll the dice for movement, do you have to move the full distance? Presumably,
no. No, you don't. It's a bit like chain of command, that you can define. You can actually say, right, we're going to move. I want this platoon will move towards
the hedge,
or the hedge, or village. And when you reach the edge of the hedge or the edge of the village, you can stop there, even if you haven't gone the full move distance.
Right. Okay.
So you find the tactical bounds.
Yeah, because it's quite an interesting mechanic for me to look at it, that, you know, it's Second World War, it's platoons and sections running from cover to cover, and you say, I'm moving from here to here, as you say, or this feature to this feature.
Yeah.
But your movement is 2d6. So it could, you could end up caught short, so to speak, and caught in the open, or you could end up getting there quite comfortably. So there's a huge amount of randomness. It's very much a game of orders and command capability, not quite command points. It's sort of command points, isn't it? But there's different layers of commandability.
I mean, what I like is the fact that your company command order can be quite useful. Not that I've played it yet, obviously, in that you can then give second command to a unit who's already had a command. So that probably is the key thing for making things happen and can sort of save you from a, you know, you want to move 8 inches to that.
But it can be quite expensive.
Cost you, what, two or three or something, yeah.
It can cost you up to three orders.
Yeah.
Orders.
So then your troops run out of orders, of course, and then suddenly end up not being able to do anything. I also really like that mechanic of the what they call the sort of the recce platoons or something like that. Combat patrols. So you move markers around that are little recce groups or whatever, and there's presumably quite a lot of terrain on table that obscures line of sight. And then once you get these markers in position, you can choose to bring your reserve units, of which you end up having quite a few, on table onto the position of some of these markers. So it's sort of got a mix of dynamic deployment, but dynamic deployment about where you choose to invest command points, shoving your troops up to. So
yeah,
so
combat patrols. You can't put them within 8 inches of the enemy, and I think if the enemy come within 8 inches, you've got to move them back, I think, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you're sort of playing around with these markers, but it's not, you know, you can do ambushes or you can do this kind of thing, but they're not locked in place. It's part of the game system to create
Ambushes are locked.
Yeah. De facto ambushes using your reserves. You balance it on the fly. And then the combat mechanics seem super, super simple. You know, it's just D4, hit, you shoot at a whole platoon, it shoots at a whole platoon, you know, plus one modifiers for cover and things like that. It really does look quite cute, I think. And it's a nicely produced book.
Although
the layout, as somebody pointed out, sort of PDF obviously looked fine. And then they inserted the adverts.
Oh, right, okay.
Which meant that page numbers and the chapter headings ended up on the inside fold rather than the outer edge.
Oh,
one, Tamsin, or just the PDF?
I've got both.
Yeah, me too.
Actually, yeah, sorry, I've just been reading the PDF, but you're right, yeah. Yes, that's true. The page numbers and the little words down the side that are supposed to say what section you're on are actually on the inside, which is a little bit awkward, as in it doesn't work at all. I think the one thing I was slightly surprised about for a modern, you know, a brand new set of rules is that the orders mechanic is about command points, and that's a different way of doing a very familiar, you know, it's pips plus or pips different. But the orders phase is old school written, move forwards and occupy that hill. The top level orders, the instructions that you give to people, and I was sort of slightly surprised at that.
To an extent, you have to define sort of which is actually quite realistic. Company A will operate on the north side of the road. Company B will operate on the south side, which defines their area of activity.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think it's literally, very, very literally realistic, because that's kind of writing orders. But I suppose I'm still slightly surprised to see that amount of literality, if that's a word, in a modern rule set, when so much of the other stuff is cleverly abstracted. It's like, it kind of jars a little bit.
Folks, in this case, you are looking at what orders you are the battalion or Italian stroke battle group commander. What orders would you be giving realistically? It would be Company A will operate on the north side, Company B on the south side, you'll go forward. Your objectives are this, this, and this.
And the set of rules is called orders group.
Yeah.
There you go. No, I think it is, but I kind of am used to that stuff being abstracted as well. And there's this mix between the sending of signals and command capability being abstracted in a really clever way, and then a 1970s-esque, I'm going to write down that you should operate north of the river and, you know, move forwards up to the hill. It just struck me as a little bit odd, but...
you don't actually have to write it down, you just have to state it.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Just remember it and pretend not to cheat.
You have to write it down, and it's like, you've written orders, but it's not like that. It's, you've got your plan, Company A goes north, Company B goes south, and Company A will go to... first objective line is this village. Maybe it's this farm or this wood. When you get there, secondary objectives, or you could deploy reserve companies onto that position to go for to take it forward.
Yeah, no, I get it, but that was the one thing that jumped out at me after reading all this other clever stuff. It's like, that's a mechanic from the 70s, but I don't think it's just different, isn't it? It's just the way you do it. It slightly surprised me. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It just sort of slightly surprised me, given the way the rest of it's been put together.
I think what'll be interesting is when things start falling apart, you start taking damage in your army, and then how do you balance your command points in terms of do you... And obviously, it depends partly on the diaries. Are you going to override the food bar and, you know, hope that nobody goes hesitant or whatever it might be?
Yeah,
it does feel like it will be about that balance of do you keep pushing them when they start to get, you know, dig their heels in and get stuck. But it'll be interesting. I think I may well attempt to put some soldiers on table and shove them around and just see how it works over the next week or so.
I might do that the weekend. Yeah.
Just before we go on and leave from this, something I wanted to say last week, something you said, Tim, you said, so I've got some armies for PBI that seem to be based the same, so I could use them for this. And at the time I meant to say, but I couldn't be asked, but I will say now that PBI is an excellent set of rules. So if you're looking for a company-sized set of World War II rules, give PBI a go. It's a really good game.
No, it's a very good game, I think. Although even Martin at Peter Pig would probably admit that whatever it was, version 3 or something, got a little bit overcomplicated. And I think it's one of those rule sets that, you know, for Second World War infantry actions and company and, you know, company platoon actions, a lot of it was enormous volumes of fire got chucked at each other with very few people being hit and everybody hit in the dirt and taking cover. And you can get bogged down and quite quickly and just throw huge volumes of fire at each other and everybody keeps their heads down.
People would just go for the assault instead, but, you know, artillery on target and then go for the assault.
Yeah, but in this sort of smaller scale, it's almost a little below the scale of artillery coming into it. It's platoons and companies. And that bit of, you know, being a bit bogged down and finding it hard to move forwards feels very realistic, but sometimes it does make for almost a bit of a sort of like the issues I had with playing Rommel, in that it's a grid-based game and it's about knowing how to achieve the objectives through almost sort of
game. It depends if they're mechanics. Able to break them down to a sort of section level. Otherwise, it just becomes a bit irrelevant, because the whole idea when, you know, you're bogged down in that instant is that you send sections around, you know.
This game's got independent sections for sure. Absolutely, for sure. But it can sometimes grind a bit down, and you are rolling an awful lot of dice to represent the volume of fire. But no, it's a great game.
A great game. But having said what I've said, thinking about it, I do think Bayonet and Ideology is a better game, because it's Spanish Civil War and it's basically the same game, but with less machine guns.
Yes. Yeah. And less volume of fire and more people who are happy to charge the enemy at bayonet point, which is more sporting, really, isn't it, I guess? Yeah. And on that sporting note, we'll wrap up this section. This means war. So look, we've done O Group. We've done what games we played. We've had a remarkable first in I'm Sorry, I Think You're an Arse. And keeping with that pattern of mixing up the old and the new and the regular, I think it's the most regular man we've got, the metronome of quiz questions, Mr. Andy Finkel. And we will go over to you and we will roll Andy's quiz music. Well, questions indeed. Andy, what questions do you have for us this week? Or in fact, what answers do you have for us for this week?
Well, les réponses for this week is, last week's questions were just words. So the first question was, what does the term hoist on his own petard literally mean?
Blown up by your...
string.
By your firearm.
By your own petard. A petard's a bomb.
Sort of lifted up by your own bomb.
Blown up by your own explosive device, that's correct. In World War II, what was a Tommy cooker?
German.
Two answers to this. One is for either folding stove, which was issued to the British troops.
German tank.
And the second one was Sherman tank, particularly.
Sherman tank, yes.
Oh, good.
And third one is, what is the literal original meaning of the term deploy?
To unfold.
The opposite of ploy.
Yes, that's correct. It is the opposite of ploy, but in sort of military terms, what does it actually mean?
To unfold or reveal.
Well, what it actually means is to get a column of troops and form them into a line.
Okay, which army or which thing is that
I
from?
Think it came from the French in the 18th century, because if, and that's where you get things about the right of the line. So if you look at how an 18th century army used to march onto the battlefield, they'd be in columns of three or four, and the elite regiments would be in the head, and you kind of march them at right angles to where you wanted them to go, and then said halt, turn left, and then they're essentially in a line in the right relative position
so
to each
would
other.
Would deploy mean turn a line into a column?
Yes.
Okay.
French.
Right. Okay then. Well, that's the answers. So that means we get another bout of quiz music. So Andy, we're here again, and it's another week. So last week, the topic of words was a little under-imaginative, it must be said. But let's tell us you've got something more expansive this week. What's this week's surrealness?
Well, I listened to a part of a podcast from a different games set called Meg, and they were talking about a thing called tugs. And... I think that's some kind of military unit. I don't think it's to do with little ships. But gave me the idea. So this week's theme is pulling rank. So the first question is, if a major outranks a lieutenant, why does a lieutenant general outrank a major general?
I think talking about tugs and outranking is, we've got to get the audio very careful on this, Ron, but it's definitely a good question. Right, okay.
Okay, the second question is in 1943, a civilian called Glendora Michael was given a false identity as Major William Martin of the Royal Marines. What role did he play in the invasion of Sicily?
Oh, I know that okay. one.
Oh, that could be one. All right then, okay. And your
And the third question is, at the Battle of Cannae in 216 BCE, why was the Roman army commanded by Consul Varro rather than his co-consul Paulus?
I'm almost scared to think what the answer to that one might be that fits into this thing. But no, that's a good note to end it on. We will carefully tiptoe back to those answers next week. Thank you, Andy. Question. La légende le dit. Question. Elle dit aussi. Question. So look, the quiz music fades into the background. Hopefully the memories of those questions fade into the background as well. So we've only got time for a quick go around the screen to see what people are up to next week. So let's start with Peter. I guess you're doing internet shopping. You're waiting for input and feedback for your shopping, and you're hoping to make glue
shopping
work.
And Aerodyte for winged hussars, and try not to stick various parts of my body together. So carrying on with that in between a bit craziness at work. But I definitely like the idea. You know, the problem is I've been looking at lists as we've been doing the podcast, and that the fortunate thing is now I get to buy more.
Right. Okay. So basically, we'll know if you've got the hussar wings if you come back doing a Vulcan salute properly next week. That could be it. All right then. Adam, what about you? Are you working up ahead of steam for another rant, or just finishing off little ships?
Oh, I can break the rants out at the moment's notice, but I'll be doing little ships and I'll be doing the baggage. But it's like, as I say, it's like I'm working at the moment. So wargaming is slowing down, but that's kind of okay. But I'll be painting things as I go along.
Pick it up as you get older.
Yes. Tamsin, what about you? You're going to dig out the budgie sand or something for the 6mm 1/300 scale?
Well, if we're back to Monday recording next week, I probably won't have got to that stage. But
if we record later in the week, then it depends if what day we do the recording.
Yeah.
How much budgie sand you'll have to report on.
Yeah.
Okay. Dave, you look like you're in a sort of a hutch-based environment from the angle of that camera, with budgie sand scattered on the floor. What's your next week? Are you going to manage to finish off the commission work and start some stuff of your own?
No. I mean, it'll be... the infantry are done. I'll have the last of the six packs done. It'll be the two 12s of cavalry will be the next mission. Got a good idea where they need to... And then finally, the Scotsman.
Did you pick up that stuff on Tartan from last week?
Yeah, no. I watched the podcast, sorry, not the YouTube thing from the, what was the guy's name?
Cujo.
Very good, very good. It's like paint a line. And it's like, right, so that's the secret. You don't do a line and another line. You do a line, miss a line. So, I'm looking forward to doing some tartan nonsense. That's going to be a bit of a laugh.
Well, we'll go back and record you saying paint a line, miss a line, paint, because I'm sure we can market that as a ringtone for some very niche part of the world as well. And then, Simon, what about you? What's now that this world-beating, world-covering Ottoman army is completed, what's next on your list?
So I'm going for a suitable opponent. So I'm going for the Hoplites and the Alexander the Great army. So just go, vaguely the same part of the world, just a slight difference in era. So
have you even done the undercoating for that yet? Or is it
kind of... I did do the undercoating. It was vaguely warm on the weekend. So they're now all base coated grey, because that's the only base coat I had available. And they're on the painting table.
Ah, so something new to report by next week with a bit of luck then.
Hopefully. It is end of financial year, so who knows what could happen between now and then.
So then, Simon, that's you. And then finally for me, I think hopefully I could actually get these Thracian and Persian cavalry done, which might be, 1, 2, 3, 7, 4s. There might be about 40 cavalry might get done because they're pretty close. And then I'll probably go onto the Donington website and put in an order for a few more Zeist and Thracians. So if any of you want a few more extra bits of Donington stuff, let me know fairly soon, because there's probably a smallish order going in there, and doing a bit more stuff. Hopefully these army list packs will come out for the Aztecs and the Mesoamericans, and we'll try and get a podcast especially about those put together as well. But on that note, with a fairly lengthy episode actually this week, which hopefully you've all enjoyed, we will love you and leave you. And actually, the one other thing is tomorrow I get vaccinated, so injection-orama. I will be stabbed again. Another fantastic reason why the aging of the hobby is great. You know, we are genetically now programmed. I think they're just picking wargamers, really. It's that's a secret. They know that we're very good at socially distancing, so it's a reward for that, I suspect. But on that note, we will love you all and leave you, and goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
See you, mate.
I think we'll get some reaction on that one.
Next time I won't hold back.
No. We'll find one.
I think we should do, actually, we could do a new feature. I could be the agony aunt.
Yeah, you're not meant to inflict agony, though.
Should I try and book a table for place for the Saturday night if it's open? The
No, that was horrible. I'm sorry, I went there once. It was horrible.
Okay. This means war.
This means war.
You mean we haven't had any complaints about this so far?